Our third case for this morning is the Central States Southwest Areas Pension Fund against Clip Venture LLC and others, 13-3010, 13-3776. So when you're ready, Ms. Tesmer. Okay.
May it please the Court, I'm Tricia Tesmer on behalf of the defendants' appellants, and I'd respectfully request that this Court reverse the District Court's finding and granting summary judgment on behalf of the appellees.
In your reply brief, you highlight the fact that under the terms of the stock redemption agreement, Pierre Annunzi could pursue his right to a return of the stock in escrow in the event that GBO did not make the scheduled payments. First of all, I'm not sure the stock redemption agreement actually says that, but even assuming that it does, the assignment agreement, which postdates the stock redemption agreement, says that Pierre Annunzi relinquishes, waives, and releases any rights he may have had under the stock purchase agreement. So for purposes of Pierre Annunzi's rights, the stock redemption agreement is a dead letter, isn't it?
No, Your Honor. It's defendant's contention. We've read paragraphs 4 and 5 of the assignment, but we'd focus the Court's attention on paragraph 6, which says in the event the assignee fails to make payments, the assignor has the right to declare the balance immediately due and, the key language, pursue any legal remedies against the assignee. And it's defendant's contention that he can ask for a share return at that point. Further, we have Mr. Moran's testimony, and taken in the light most favorable to the defendants, that he continued to vote these shares, that they did not go to Cebulo, and in terms of common control, there needs to be 80% ownership by Mr. Cebulo.
But he had to vote them under instructions from Mr. Cebulo. He wasn't free under the terms of the earlier agreement just to vote them in whatever way he was moved.
Actually, under the default, he was required to abstain from voting.
Which is the same thing. So the legal test has to do with control. And if you have to take off the table those shares that were abstained, that leaves Mr. Cebulo in charge of everything.
With 100% of the voting power.
It can be construed that way, however.
These are documents. I mean, these are the kinds of things that courts construe. And I'm having trouble, as Judge Rovner is, actually, first of all, with this 2004 agreement, if I'm remembering the year correctly, and then even going back to the 1998 stock redemption agreement, it looks to me like either way you cut it, by the time all of this happens, Mr. Cebulo controls 100%.
We contend there's a question of fact on that, Your Honor, based upon not only the language of these agreements, but based upon Mr. Moran's deposition testimony that he continued to attend meetings, to abstain, and that these voting rights could not go to Mr. Cebulo.
But I don't hear anything in that testimony from Mr. Moran that you're talking about that undermines the legal interpretation of the stock. I mean, he can be sitting there in the meetings. He can be following the instructions of Mr. Cebulo to abstain, but that still leads to the legal conclusion that it's Mr. Cebulo who's controlling things. So I don't see where the deposition is even inconsistent, and even if it were, I'm not sure it could contradict the written agreements, especially the 2004 one.
Mr. Cebulo and Mr. Moran testified that in his deposition that Mr. Cebulo couldn't do anything to change the bylaws pursuant to the bylaws and pursuant to the Illinois Corporations Act, that they required a unanimous vote, and it wouldn't be a unanimous vote with the shares still being placed in the hands of Mr. Moran.
Does Cebulo have a right to possession here?
Well, based upon the assignment and the paragraphs 4 and 5 that Your Honor pointed out, he may. However, when you look at the Sentra case, it says you need to look at the seller's power to revoke. And here, the power to revoke still lied with Mr. Pierannunzi.
But how can you reconcile that? I'm looking at the bottom of page 5 and the top of page 6 of the Appellee's brief, which quotes from the 2004 agreement. And it says, Mr. Pierannunzi assigns to Cibula all rights that he has or holds as the secured party, and then they've italicized it, including the right to demand a transfer from GOBO to assignee of Asinor's shares in the event of a default. So I see Pierannunzi as just giving it up. It's left in Cibula at that point.
In fact, even if the right to the stock redemption agreement hasn't been nullified by the later assignment, how would we know that Pierannunzi's right, and this is in quotes, to pursue any and all legal remedies available would include the right to a share return of his stock in escrow? I mean, how do we know any of that?
First of all, the stock redemption agreement never transferred the shares to Cibula. In terms of the assignment, which is the 2004 language that Your Honor was quoting, you were quoting paragraph 4. However, in paragraph 6, it says he can pursue any and all legal remedies, and a legal remedy would be to obtain his shares back.
But why would it? That would be in the same document. You wouldn't ordinarily construe a contract to have in one section of the contract say, I'm giving up this right, and in another section of the contract say, I'm now nullifying two paragraphs earlier. Whatever rights remain would be pursuable, but you're not going to construe the contract to make one section null and void. I mean, that's a classic principle of contract interpretation. It's the way Illinois courts interpret contracts. So I'm just having trouble seeing how that right, at least, could be being referred to in this paragraph 6.
That was the party's understanding. And even if we construe it that way, it still remains open, these open shares that were being controlled by Moran, because GEO-BEO was still in default and wasn't making payments, and it required a unanimous vote in which Cibula couldn't make a unanimous vote because he did not control 80% or more of the vote.
What do you mean by control of it?
He did not have ownership of.
Well, but ownership is the same.
Distinguishable from control.
But controlling interest is defined as ownership of stock possessing at least 80% of the total combined voting power of all classes of stock entitled to the vote. And here, it's all the same class of stock, and there's a percentage of the stock that was entitled to vote, even though it's being voted as an abstention. It's still being voted, and it couldn't require
Well, but you're making too close a link between ownership and control. The effective control is 80% of the combined voting power. Some corporations have non-voting shares of stock. Some have other arrangements. And by the time you have even the 1998 agreement, Cibula has 100% of the combined voting power because Moran has to abstain. He can't vote. Now, maybe for other purposes of other laws, there's some things Cibula can't do, but that's we're dealing with this law and the Multiple Employer Pension Act, and this definition of control is combined voting power.
And it's defendant's contention that the abstention votes would be votes and would reduce.
But they don't vote when you have to abstain. I mean, you could call it a vote, I suppose, but you're not saying yes or no.
But based upon the testimony of Moran, it precluded Mr. Cibula from changing the agreement and making decisions because it did require unanimous.
And that's what I'm saying. They're different purposes, but anyway.
Yeah. So in terms of common control, it's defendant's position that under the stock redemption agreement and the assignment, that ownership interest by Cibula never exceeded 73%.
Can I take you elsewhere for a moment, please? Can you cite any cases in which a business corporation or other formal business entity has successfully argued that it is not a trade or business?
No, Your Honor, I have not seen one other than the one that was cited by the appellee regarding the Shell Corporation. However, there's no law per se that a trade or business that an LLC cannot be a trade or business. It's not a per se rule. And the primary test is the Grotzinger test, where you look at the primary purpose of income or profit and continuity and regularity. And here,
for instance, what about business expense deductions? How does an entity have business expense deductions without running a business?
That's a good question, Your Honor. And it's
I know. And you have to answer it.
It is something that the courts have said you should consider in deciding this. However, we'd like to focus your attention on some of the things that make it not a business, and that's the fact that Mr. Cibula spent less than 10 hours a year on activities related to these businesses.
But that's not the business, though. I mean, he's participating to a certain degree, but they're simply operating through the use of independent contractors and other agents, even if they don't have employees. You don't have to have employees to run a business. For that matter, you could be a solely owned enterprise, sole proprietorship. So you look at Lathrop Star, for example, they're earning, you know, well, they have $232,000 in business deductions. They're a distinct entity. They're filing a federal income tax return under their federal employer ID number. And on, you go through all of these things, and if it's a Grotzinger test, it's in all the circumstances, and boy, there are not many circumstances in this case that suggest they aren't businesses.
Just to add to that, contracting a management company to run one's business still counts as running a business, doesn't it?
That's not a per se rule, Your Honor. We would like this court to hold that this is closer to the Fulkerson and the White cases versus the SCOFBP case cited by plaintiff's counsel. And the facts that support that are that there is no evidence in the record of buying and selling multiple properties. The evidence in the record is that Mr. Cibula spent less than 10 hours a year on these properties, and that there was no continuity and regularity, which puts it closer to the Fulkerson case than it does the SCOFBP case.
Okay.
Does the court have any other questions?
If you'd like to save rebuttal time, why don't you do that?
Thank you.
We'll hear from Mr. Withers.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Tom Withers. I represent the appellees in this matter. I'd like to start with the issue of common control, because defendant's reply brief on this issue was a little confused. We have two operative agreements, and the material agreement is the assignment, but the original agreement was a stock redemption agreement between Mr. Piranunzi and GOBO.
So in other words, you're saying the 2004 agreement is the one that...
That has legal relevance, okay. But the other agreement is relevant because it sets up the background facts for the assignment. Now, GOBO was obligated to make periodic payments to Mr. Cibula under the stock redemption agreement.
And this is where he's getting little tranches of stock?
Right. For various periodic payments, he would get various partial stock certificates out of the 350.
And that's what brings him up to 73%.
Right. Yeah. But GOBO fell into default under the stock redemption agreement. It appears at page 3 and 4 of appellant's reply brief that they're arguing that Mr. Cibula fell into default under the stock assignment. And there's no cite to the record. There's nothing in the record. That argument wasn't made in their opening brief. In fact, Mr. Cibula simply paid Mr. Piranunzi under the assignment and instantly acquired all the rights to Mr. Piranunzi there. Now, if Mr. Cibula had been in default on another assignment, there might have been those reversionary rights that counsel was talking about under paragraph 6, but those amounts were paid. Now, there's no record on that because that was not contested either in the district court or the opening brief and is only raised in the reply brief, so nobody made a record on that. But Mr. Cibula testified in his deposition very clearly that all those amounts were paid.
So let me just make sure I'm clear on what you're saying. So at the time of the 2004 assignment agreement, you're saying Mr. Cibula pays up whatever he's whatever
the,
he owes
the
Mr.
required consideration, yes.
And
so there's no way Mr.
Piranesi
could ever get back into the picture because he is sold and paid. Now you have this ongoing dispute between GOBO and now Mr. Cibula, who's bought the residual and reversionary rights, as to where those rights land. But again, however you parse those rights, those are immaterial because Mr. Cibula controls the buyer, GOBO, and he's bought the rights of the seller. He has the entire transaction, and Mr. Piranesi has no rights left at all.
Okay, so in sum, what you're saying, let me just be sure, is that voting control of the escrow shares is vested in Cibula under the terms of the assignment agreement that was in effect at the time of the withdrawal. And so the defendants are liable for the withdrawal penalty. That's what you're saying, I think.
Well, I think our primary argument is that in light of the default, Mr. Cibula had the right to direct the return of those shares out of the escrow to himself personally, at which point he would have been in direct control of all the shares.
Before or after the assignment?
After the assignment.
Okay.
Now, he never exercised that right, but in light of the regulatory language that makes a person the constructive owner of stock, he has an option.
Because he had the right to do it, that was enough
right.
under the regulation.
Now, the second argument is the argument Judge Rovner explained, that once the default was declared, that stock sitting in the escrow ceased to be stock entitled to vote. And if you look at the regulatory language, the controlling interest is ownership of stock possessing at least 80% of total combined voting power of all classes of stock entitled to vote.
So, forgive me, but in other words, even were we to ignore the later assignment and
right.
look only at the stock purchase agreement, as the defendants do, once GOB is in default, the escrowee was required to abstain from voting on any of the shares in
right.
escrow. So
right.
Cibula has 100% of the voting power at the time of the withdrawal.
Right, that's our secondary argument.
And
but
so either way,
right.
they lose.
Right. Now, if you look at the language of the regulations.
Your arguments are.
Right. I think if
okay.
you look.
Okay.
I'm sorry. But if you look at the language of the regulation concerning common control, I think it's clear, certainly to me, that the regulation is concerned with practical control. Defendant's position would have you read the regulation, ownership of 80% of all classes of voting stock. Defendant's interpretation doesn't give any meaning to the additional wording of the regulation concerning voting power and stock entitled to vote. And I would remind the court that the escrow agreement is contained, the escrow provisions are contained in the stock redemption agreement. Ordinary voting agreements as to voting rights of stock are enforceable. Here, it's not a private agreement. Here, it's a shareholder agreeing with the issuing corporation that this stock will cease to be voting stock.
Mm-hmm. I have an odd question, which is this whole bit of litigation comes along rather late in the day, right? You the plan brings the original action against the first set of defendants, and that gets settled, right, for the withdrawal of the million and whatever it is.
It was a consent judgment.
Yeah,
that first
a consent judgment. And then I guess you're just not getting the money or something, so you went back, you know, to see if you could find more entities that are legally accountable?
Right. The original judgment defendants had no assets. And this is mm-hmm. pretty typical in cases of this type, that the pension fund doesn't have access to financial information, collectability information, stock information to find other trades or businesses under common control until it gets a judgment against somebody. Then when it has post-judgment discovery rights, that's when the information starts coming about other entities under common control.
Okay.
Huh. I just want to say I can't get over all of you ERISA lawyers. It is so arcane and difficult. You are so smart.
If the court has no further questions on the common control, I'd like to turn to the trader business.
Yeah, I think the trader business would be good. There's one point I wanted to ask you about that. which is this coin laundry, Main Street laundry,
right.
Where we know that it's involuntarily dissolved by the Secretary of State of Illinois in October 2006. And at one point, I understood the defendants to be saying, oh, there was just a typo when we admitted that it's still, when Cibula admits that it's still operating in 2005. He says it was really stopped in 2004. Could you clarify some of that?
Well, I think if you want to give defendant the benefit of the inference here, you could give them the benefit that active business operations ceased in 2004. But there's clear evidence that it was an active trader business prior to 2004. And I know we cite legal authority in our summary judgment brief in front of the district court showing that once you've established that a legal condition pertains, it's assumed to continue until there's evidence to the contrary. There's no evidence to the contrary here. I mean, they make the statement in the brief, but that's not in the record. The corporation continued to exist as a business corporation. The operating agreement for the coin laundry was still in place. And in the Messina case, a similar situation came up where the parties argued that, well, you can't look at the operating agreement because it's outdated and circumstances have changed. But the court pointed out in that case, well, if circumstances have changed, you should have amended your operating agreement. They didn't do it in Messina, and they didn't do it here.
I mean, so, is it really likely that you're going to get that much money out of Main Street Laundry? I mean, I guess I don't know.
No, highly unlikely to almost certain that we won't. But, again, when we filed this suit however many years ago, again, we had no information on collectability. Mm-hmm. They were clearly a trader business under common control, so we pursued everybody we found.
So I have another question. Your opponent, with respect to these various entities, stresses that Mr. Cibula personally wasn't spending very much time. I'm not sure whether the argument is collectively or per entity, but under the Grotzinger test, does it matter how much of a hand he has in it if there's common ownership?
No, that's why we think that summary judgment was totally appropriate in this case, that there's really no genuine issue as to material fact. We'll concede that Mr. Cibula personally spent less than 10 hours on each of these corporations. But we're not pursuing Mr. Cibula. He's not a defendant. It doesn't matter what the shareholder did. If you look at any publicly traded corporation,
that's what I thought, yeah.
The shareholders frequently have no management activity for the corporation. They frequently buy the stock with an investment intent. But that goes to the shareholder's economic activity. Here we're looking at the business corporation itself.
So that would be relevant only, I mean, Mr. the number of hours he spends would be relevant only if he were another defendant.
Right.
Okay.
And if you look at the body of case law addressing the trader business issue, most of those cases involve an individual defendant with personal economic activity, and the dispute is, does that activity rise or not rise to the level that where it would meet the Grotzinger test? Mm-hmm. Here we have a business corporation. The most analogous case out of this court is the what we call the Scoff case.
I think of it as Scoff BP, and right. I don't know.
But again, in that case, you had business corporations. It was one of the few cases where a business corporation has tried to argue that it wasn't a trader business. And the activities here are virtually identical by nature with the activities in the Scoff case, but they're greater in magnitude. The basics of the Grotzinger test are the activity has to be conducted with regularity and continuity with an intent for profit. But the Grotzinger test also, Grotzinger Court rather, identifies three other factors as a way to analyze those higher level questions. It looks to the intent for forming the legal entity, the legal form of the entity, and the tax treatment.
Now, can you think of any case where you had entities like these LLCs that filed business tax returns and took business deductions in which they were not found to be a trade or business?
No, the only we admitted in our brief in the footnote that there is the Stroh Brewery case, which is a bankruptcy case,
right,
where a shell corporation was formed, had no assets, no activity whatsoever. And in that case, it was found not to be a trade or business.
Basically a piece of paper, right.
But this case is far removed from that. The legal intent is expressed in the operating agreement. Again, in the Scoff BP case, this court held that an intent to hold real estate could be a business purpose. Here the intent goes much farther. It's an intent to lease and operate commercial property. Mm-hmm. The legal form of the entities are all for-profit, either corporations or LLCs. And I think the most significant factor is the tax treatment. Collectively, in the year of withdrawal alone, the appellants took $3.5 million in tax deductions. They file tax returns telling the Department of Treasury, under the Grotzinger test, we're a trader business entitled to these deductions. And now they stand here in court today telling you, oh, we're not a trader business, under the same Grotzinger tax test. So, now, within that $3.5 million, as a couple members of the court have pointed out, there are explicit expenses for management, maintenance to the property, advertising. You don't advertise an investment. I think the evidence is overwhelming on the trader business issue that there's no way that this court could reverse the district court. Which brings me to the standard of review issue. I think this court could easily affirm the district court under either the de novo or the clearly erroneous standard. We argued it in the brief because I think clearly erroneous is the right standard. It's well supported by any number of cases from this court. Two cases from last year alone, Nagy and Messina, applied the clearly erroneous standard. But if this court was to find that it could affirm under the de novo standard, the court could avoid both the standard of review question and the jury trial question.
The jury trial question, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, it's interesting because it really depends on how far you pick apart the issues in the case. I mean, ERISA, derived from trust law, is fundamentally equitable, but on the other hand, there are issues that can come up along the way that look a little more legal in nature.
Right. Well, if you look at the particular nature of this cause of action, it's a statutory cause of action, unlike anything that existed in common law in 1789. It was created by Congress. And Congress decided that the dispute resolution in the first instance would be by mandatory arbitration. So there's clearly no right to a jury if you're in front of an arbitrator. Defendants argue that it's all different because we argued we're not under common control. Well, under the Slotkey case, by arguing that they're not under common control, they get out of the mandatory arbitration and get to go to district court. But there's no argument for the next step that now that they're in district court, they also get to go to a jury. And in particular, the only question they identify in their brief as appropriate for a jury is whether ERISA applies. And that's a question of law in any event. Even if you had a jury trial, that question would go to the court.
Of course, your view is that the point is moot because you believe the court correctly resolved the matter.
Under any standard. That's right.
Right. I mean, there's obviously no right to a jury if the case is appropriate for summary judgment and there are no disputed issues of fact for the jury.
Right. If I could just make one more point. In the Slotkey case, the rationale behind that is if this court were to apply a de novo standard and send it back, you're sending it back to the same fact finder. It's a document case. That fact finder is going to review the same record, and it'll come back up again under the clearly erroneous standard. I think that's why the court applies clearly erroneous in the first instance in these type of cases.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Withers. Anything further, Ms. Tesmer?
Very briefly, Your Honors. You asked a question about the coin laundry, and I did want to clear up what was put in my briefs. The record does show that they did cease operations in 2004, but we did admit that they were dissolved in 2006.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of common control and trade or business, we would ask that this court reverse the trial court's motion for summary judgment and find that there's a question of fact in terms of what was the voting power, was there voting power, whether an abstention vote by Mr. Moran could preclude Mr. Cibula, as he states, and as Mr. Moran states, from voting, thus holding common control, and in terms of trade or business, we would ask the court to look at the activities of Mr. Cibula or the lack thereof. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.